If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 378, Remember and Imagine, with guest Derek Jensen, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. In this episode of the podcast, I will play most of a conversation that I recorded in Crescent City, California, at Jefferson State Books with Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen has been a guest on this podcast before, and he probably needs no introduction, although he is the author of many books. Most recently, though, he is one of the contributing authors to a book put out by Orion Magazine. It's called Change Everything Now, a selection of essays from Orion Magazine. Looking at the Orion Magazine webpage, they describe the book as follows. A new art form has evolved in the pages of Orion over the last 30 years. Call it the literature of ecological urgency. No longer content to settle for diminutive steps that don't add up, the authors in this collection are calling for paradigmatic change, tackling such subjects as corporatism, consumerism, toxic chemicals, even environmentalism itself. These pieces share a common message. If our culture fails to adequately address the challenges of our age, things could get very bad for people and for nature. The Orion essays collected here are not just a call to action, but a call to bold and brave action, commensurate with the level of transformation that is required of humanity at this moment in time. Contributors include Derek Jensen, Jeffrey Kaplan, James Howard Kunstler, Winona LaDuke, Bill McKibben, Janice Ray, Rebecca Solnit, James Gustave Speth, Sandra Steingraber, and Curtis White. And now, here is my conversation with Derek Jensen.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO. I am in Crescent City, California, sitting down with Derek Jensen. Derek, welcome back to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, and thanks for your work.
Where are we now?
We are in Jefferson State Books, which is a fabulous bookstore in Crescent City, California. The owner has done a tremendously courageous thing by A, opening a bookstore in this economy, and B, opening a fabulous intellectual, environmental, and otherwise bookstore in the extremely, and basically Tea Party country on the North Coast. It's extremely conservative here, and he's doing a great thing both for the word and for politics.
Our host last night, Larry Goldberg, down in Trinidad, California, he suggested that we ask you about Pelican Bay Supermax Prison and its role in the community here and in the politics.
I don't know what its effects on politics are, because it is true that it is one of the engines of the local economy, and I am guessing it would be true that the people who work at the prison are, for the most part, more politically conservative than average.
Even for this region or nationally?
See, I don't know. That's what I was going to get to, is that this was a... The politics here are really strange, because you have some sort of back-to-the-lander lefty types, and you also have back-to-the-lander survivalist righty types, and then you also have a typical Western rural economy where they simultaneously rely on handouts from the government and hate the government. And so it's all, you know, it's like we hate big government, and meanwhile, of course, Pelican Bay is the engine of the economy, which is government spending. So it's a very typical rural economy. Used to be based on a lot on timber and fishing, but that's for the most part gone. And as it happens everywhere, I mean, these are you know, neither timber nor commercial fishing economies are sustainable. They're extractive economies, and when the extraction's done, then people get pissed off and attempt to maintain that and get angry at those who point out that the beings whom they consider resources are gone. The communities they consider resources are gone. And this is also an interesting community because so much of this county is owned by the state and Fed, and this makes the local politicians very upset. They often look with gold lust in their eyes at the parks that have been set aside, and so on.
They would love to cut them down.
Oh, sure,
timber.
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
Before we go any further, I should mention that we are gathered here because Eric Hoffner suggested that we do this. He works for Orion Magazine, and you are a columnist for Orion Magazine. And they have a new book out, and it's packed somewhere deep in the bowels of the back of the truck, and I don't have the title at the ready. But you are a contributor to that book, and I would just invite you to talk for whatever length is comfortable about Orion Magazine, their mission, and your role there.
Well, I was approached, 5 or 6 years ago to maybe 4 or 5, I don't know, several years ago, to write a column for them every issue. And I was approached by Jennifer Son. And this is not just, you know, sort of the standard public rhetoric of, you know, you're always supposed to say nice things about the people you work with. But she's a fabulous editor. That's what I'm saying. That's not just me being nice. She's great. I think my pieces are supposed to be about 1,000 words, 1,100 words. And often what I've done is I will hand in, say, 1,900 words and trust her completely to be able to pull the best 1,000 words out of it. And, I mean, she then shows it to me, but usually when she shows me the edits, it's like, so what do you think about this? Almost always is all I can say is fabulous. I mean, she's been great to work with on every level. There's been, you know, this is sort of off topic, but it's interesting because we talk a lot about, and I wrote a column years ago about censorship and how a lot of censorship doesn't happen because the government says don't do this, but instead, you know, your agent or your editor will say this isn't marketable. And so we end up self-censoring because we're scared we're going to, now, in fact, I got a good story about this. Well, I had only 2 books out. When I wrote A Language Older Than Words, I had, at that point, a Madison Avenue agent who was a big deal. It was their address at that point was 1 Madison Avenue. Huge, very prestigious literary organization, literary agency. And I sent her the first 70 pages of A Language Older Than Words, and she said that she thought that if I cut the family stuff and the social criticism, that I'd have a book. And I fired her on the spot. And this was... probably the most difficult day of my 30s. I was in therapy about family stuff. You know, I've written about the abuse of my family. I was in therapy for 12 years. The only day I ever cried in therapy was the day I happened to go in that day after I fired my agent. I was like, I've destroyed my career before it even began. But the point is that that's how the censorship usually takes place, is it's much more marketable. I would scare away everybody if I talked about the fact the planet's being killed. And so instead, I was supposed to just do this happy book about, you know, interspecies communication. And my point in bringing this up about Orion is that, with the exception of that, early on, I've actually been really fortunate that I've never had significant experiences of publishers or editors. Or I've got a great agent now. He's also the agent for Chomsky and Arundhati Roy and Zinn and I think Jeremy Scahill. I'm not sure. Pretty sure. Anyway, so his politics are fabulous. And my point is that I've been really fortunate in my work to not have to fight my editors as well as fighting the culture and not having to fight my publisher. The same is true of Seven Stories. They've never told me to tone things down. So I've been really fortunate that way. And so bring this back to Orion, they've never asked me to tone things down. They've been just absolutely a delight to work with.
They always have such striking and beautiful covers that my eye immediately goes to it when I'm in somebody's home and they have Orion on a coffee table or on the kitchen table or somewhere. I just instantly recognize it and realize, I'm in a comfortable, safe haven here.
They definitely have a very distinctive voice. And distinctive voice, probably the wrong word, a distinctive feel. On every level, from the beautiful writing to the beautiful, it's a very beautiful magazine.
Yeah. There is a political move afoot to deny the protections granted to the press to anybody who isn't certified as a journalist, which is to say somebody who didn't go to journalism school and have professional journalistic ethics inculcated into them over a matter of years and who isn't employed by a corporation which reports the news. So bloggers, podcasters, alternative journalists would no longer enjoy First Amendment press protection.
I mean, no, I'm not a journalist. I've never claimed to be a journalist. And people have said I'm a journalist before, and my response has always been similar to the one in the book and movie, The Virginia. It's like, smile when you say that, partner. Because I hate journalists. And I hate journalists because there's a great line by Henry Adams: the press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. I'll say that again. The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the press, set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. I remember about 19... It was when George Bush the first was president. I remember the moment that I realized how much I hate NPR. And that was, a show of All Things Considered, and George Bush the first had just talked about how people who don't want tax breaks for the rich are like Puritans who are just unhappy when anybody else has fun. And so All Things Considered was going to do, you know, their standard sort of thoughtful voice interrogation of this issue. And they said, so he said this, so that immediately leads to the question, and this is what their program was about that day: did the Puritans really have fun? It's like, seriously, we have major class war going on here. We have this major theft from the poor to the rich. And you divert the whole thing into this. This got to be a joke. And that's pretty much my experience I am stunned continually. No, not stunned. I'm jaded, but I still get mad at the way the press... You know, R.D. Lang has three rules of dysfunctional family. And rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A1 or A2. And this works for the press, too. So recently, the local newspaper, which is terribly right-wing, finally had an article about global warming. And the headline was something about global warming will benefit redwoods. It was like, finally they're talking about it. And what they have to say is, oh, here's a good thing about it. And the only way that I can understand most discourse in this culture is by thinking about insanity and going back to R.D. Lang's rules. It's just extraordinary to me. Oh, there was an article in the paper the other day, too. This just kills me. And, you know, this is just a local paper. We can do the same thing, New York Times. It doesn't matter. An Oregon local paper, which is the only time a local paper is going to be compared to New York Times. terrible thing to say. There was an article the other day that was headlined something like destroying land to save it, or something like that. And it was about how they were cutting, there's fires going on, and they're cutting fire breaks, and that hurts that land right there, obviously, to make the fire break. But actually the article wasn't about saving land, it was about saving property, because they were saying they don't want the fires to go into these towns. It's like, well then say that. Don't say you're cutting down the forest to protect the forest. Say you're cutting down the forest to protect the town. And there was an article in the LA Times or something just a couple months ago about how they're putting these massive solar installations in the desert, tremendously harmful. And they're saying destroying the desert to save the planet. It's like, no, actually, what you're doing is destroying the desert to produce additional electricity for industry. That's actually not saving the planet. That's actually producing electricity. So my point on all this is that there's a tremendous amount of censorship goes on. Have you read Robert Chesney?
I'm reading his book right now, Digital Disconnect. How capitalism is turning the internet against democracy.
Robert McChesney, he talked about, and he's not the only person to say this, about how the way, and Dick Manning talked about this. Dick Manning's written some great books. He used to be a reporter in Montana until he got fired for taking a side on environmental issues. And anyway, the way that censorship works in the corporations is not that the government comes in with a machine gun. Instead, the way the censorship generally works is if you promote capitalism, then you continue to get plum assignments, and if you don't, then you get put on the garage sale beat, you know? And Dick Manning talked about how if you actually care about the natural world, that's called getting too close to your topic. But if you're talking about making money, then that's called cultivating sources. And he also pointed out that every story has to have two sides, unless it's about a criminal, in which case it only has to have one side. And this is all, I mean, that's how the discourse works. And having said all that, I call for bringing down civilization, and so I've also had lengthy consultations with First Amendment lawyers, and honestly, having a number of books out grants somebody a certain level of protection within this system. So I wouldn't, although I'm not a journalist, I think that that insofar as these protections are worth something, that I would be protected under them. But the real question becomes, the point really is that laws are made by and for those in power, which, and I have to say, and this pisses off all the anarchists, but anarchists get pissed off at me all the time anyway, that doesn't mean, simply the fact that those in power make laws does not mean we should not have laws against rape. You know, it's like, the fact that laws are made by those in power does not mean there should be no laws. That's just ridiculous. We live in a system. I mean, you need to stop rape somehow or another. And it doesn't matter whether you call that a law or whether you call it a taboo. I mean, there need to be social rules. That's a whole other discussion we can have if you want. But the point is that I learned very much back, I already knew this, but I learned very much in the 90s with the salvage rider, that any time we figure out how to use the laws to stop the destruction, they will change the laws. And so real protection, I believe in using whatever tools we can to and whatever tools we must to attempt to bring about positive social change. But we also have to recognize that if we become effective, whatever protections they pretend we have will get thrown by the boards. And I mean, for crying out loud, you know, and here's a joke I used to tell. It's two jokes that aren't very funny. One of them is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is two life terms for murder, or at least release date 2026. Second riddle, it's not very funny. What do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full paying benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide. And we can extend that to, you know, what do you get if you put poison in the subways of Tokyo? You rightfully get put away for the rest of your life for being a terrorist. What do you get if you put poisons into the groundwater of the United States? A lot of money, because you're a fracker. And what do you call them? You call them Dick Cheney. You know, or you call them oil and gas man. You call them a gold miner. And so there's this tremendous... I mean, it's no coincidence that a lot of people call it the just us system. You know, that and this is nothing new. I mean, what is it? Who was the French guy, writer, who said that the law is blind because both a rich person and a poor person will go to prison for stealing a crust of bread? But of course, the point is that the rich person doesn't need to steal a crust of bread.
I don't know who said that.
Anyway, so the point having to do with censorship is, I think that those, here's the real deal, is that I think that those, the erosions of First Amendment protections are an entirely predictable consequence of the end of empire. I think that there are certain luxuries that can be afforded when the economy is moving along, that will, and this would include environmental protection. I mean, luxuries from that perspective. This would include social justice. This would include, you know, programs like Head Start. But when an economy starts to collapse, they're going, think about this in terms of a family. If you have a lot of disposable income, I'm going to get my teeth cleaned, you know? And then I'm going to buy lots of books for, you know, for the kiddies. And I'm going to do everything, you know, but when things get really tight, I suddenly have a choice. Am I going to buy more books to educate the children better, or am I going to pay the rent? Or if we extend this to the larger scale, am I going to buy more guns so I can steal more from my neighbors? You know, that's how it really works with the... I mean, it's entirely predictable. This is what happens at the end of empire.
Now you're kind of jaded. And I bus. Met you down at the old Douglas, baby. Now you're kind of jaded, and I am kind of faded.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast with your host, KMO.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO. I'm speaking with Derek Jensen. Derek, in the first half of the program, you mentioned that there was a newspaper article in a local paper about how global warming is good for the redwoods. And this is one aspect or one example that you covered in a recent Orion magazine column, where you talked about, I think the title of the column was Blaming the Victim, and you talked about the various responses by perpetrators to victims who come forward with allegations of wrongdoing or third-party witnesses who would support those. And that example, that it was actually good for the victim, is one of the later examples. But there were a couple other responses that were more primary and more immediate.
See if I can remember them. And I got that basically from Judith Herman, who wrote the fabulous book Trauma and Recovery. She was saying that that when someone exposes some sort of atrocity, she was saying, like, if someone comes forward to say that they were, if some woman comes forward to say she was sexually assaulted, or others come forward to expose atrocities, there's an entirely predictable series of responses. The first one really is that the thing just simply didn't happen. You're lying, or you're crazy, or you were put up to it by somebody else. And the
you have an agenda.
You have an agenda, and as opposed to the perpetrator, of course, did not have an agenda. And or as opposed to the perpetrator, who does not now have an agenda to keep it hidden. And when the evidence becomes so overwhelming that you can no longer say that things simply didn't happen, then the next level moves to, well, it was somebody else's fault. And we see this with global warming. First off, it's not happening. Second off, oh, it's natural. This is just a natural sunspot cycle or some other thing. So the second level is, so the first one is that it didn't happen. Same with sexual assault. The woman's simply lying. Second one is that, what did I just say? The second one...
It's a natural occurrence. You brought it on yourself.
Yeah, so she's wearing the short skirt. That somehow they led to it. Or somehow it's not the perpetrator's fault, whether it's the victim's fault or whether it's... and I've seen this with the Murder of the Planet, too, that... I've seen a lot of people write basically, well, you know, nature gave us just the right amount of gray matter to be able to dominate the earth. Like, so you're blaming the natural world for people in this culture choosing to vacuum the oceans? That's nuts. It's no more nuts, though, than saying that a woman was asking to be raped because she was walking around with breasts and hips and everything. I mean, what do you expect, you know? And so the next level... Okay, so first one is that it didn't happen. Second one is that it's somebody else's fault, whether it's the victim or third party something. The third one is that, I don't remember all of them, but basically another one would be that, well, so it may have happened, but it was actually good for the victim. or somehow there's a lesson to be learned here, or somehow there's some good came out of it. It's and then when that
the boy named Sue model.
Yeah. And then the next level after that is that, well, excuse me, that's all in the past now, and we need to just get on with our lives. And why do you keep bringing up the past? And this is, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Fukushima, Chernobyl, pesticides. You know, pesticides, you know, we wouldn't do these except you want cheap tomatoes. You know you want cheap tomatoes. What are you going to do? You want to go to the grocery store and not having tomatoes?
January?
Yeah, of course. Pesticides are your fault. And this is pretty much a script that is followed by perps. You know, that's something. I don't know if I've actually written about this. You know, I've written a lot about abusers and the psychology of abuse, and I don't know if I've actually said explicitly, probably somewhere, that it really is a script. And once you see the script, you can predict the next move. It's like reading a book you've read 50 times before. And, you know, back to the press, I was reading Norman Solomon and Jeff Cullen's book. They've written a bunch of books on basically how the media disinforms us. And back when I was in my 20s, I was reading one of their books, and I had just read a line about how any dictator that supports the United States is called a president, and if they are against the United States, they're called a strong man. And this was right when Noriega was being demonized, and like 2 weeks before he'd been a president. And I'm driving in my car, having just read this like 5 minutes before, and I got NPR on. I've got NPR on, and I hear them say, "Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega," and I had to pull the car over to the side of the road and just was sitting there. It's like, I get it. You know, this was just, I see the script. And I hadn't, you know, up until that point, I just knew that whenever I read something in a corporate newspaper that I knew anything about, it was wrong. Do you know one of the first times I've never said this in an interview before. One of the first times I experienced this was I was in college, and my major was, I got a degree in physics. And one day, just randomly, we happened to be talking in one of my physics classes about where people with physics degrees get jobs. And the teacher randomly happened to say that a very small percentage ends up in the nuclear industry. And, I mean, frankly, a lot of them end up in military industry somewhere. But he happened to say the percentage ended up in nuclear industry. It was fairly small. And then that same day, it happened, I read in the column in the newspaper saying why you have to have subsidies for the nuclear industry is because without it, nobody in physics will be able to get a job. And it's like, why is it every time that I know anything at all about the subject, they're lying? What does this mean about... I mean, it's like the only journalism that I could hardly stand at all is like sports journalism, because at least you know there that they're... Yeah, we know that the Yankees are great, you know? It's like, you know that they're supposed to be boosters.
They did play a game, and it was at this stage.
Yes, it's verifiable.
They did keep score, and there's no controversy about the score.
Yeah, never mind the fact that... That's another thing that breaks my heart. It's going all over the place. But that's another thing that breaks my heart is the fact that you can get 40,000 people out to a baseball game. I love baseball, but if 40,000 people out to a baseball game, you try to get people out to do something for the salmon, there's going to be three people. You know, it's just nuts. Anyway, so yeah, there's this predictable... predictable series of responses. That essay, that was one of the ones, by the way, the one you mentioned is one of the ones that one was really long when I turned it in, because I had a whole ton of examples about, just examples of the various ways this culture has denied global warming. First off, it's not happening, or also the people who are pushing it. Oh, there's these great articles about how it's these rich environmentalists are pushing their agenda. I was like, wait a second. It's the rich environmentalists versus the impoverished oil industry.
Yeah.
You know, just article after article. And then, of course, Al Gore's crazy. And then all environmentalists are crazy. Enviro wackos. You know, it's just, it goes on and on. And she cut all that because we didn't have space for I mean, that one, she had to cut probably two-thirds of that whole essay, because I just had example after example. Embarrassing number of examples.
Good editor is something to be thankful for.
Yeah.
I read David Graeber's new book, and in it he incorporates an essay that he published previously called The Neoliberal War on Imagination, in which he is describing the main agenda of the corporate media and their partnership with government as not so much to enforce a particular way of living as to wage a relentless war on anybody's ability to imagine anything other than the current system. And that it reminds me of another of your columns for Orion Magazine, where you talk about the limitations of human imagination, particularly when it comes to imagining, say, living without electricity, that this is just beyond the pale. That who could possibly imagine living without electricity when most humans who've ever lived without electricity and did all right?
I just saw an article the other day that when electricity came out in the United States, the people had to be convinced to use it because they didn't want it. And that's absolutely right. And that is one of the central functions of an oppressive philosophy, religion, or anything else, is to naturalize the oppression. This is one reason I spend so much time in so many books going after Richard Dawkins, because I think his selfish gene theory is incredibly harmful. The notion that what he's doing is he's naturalizing the oppression. And if you can get people to believe that the oppression is natural and not a result of choices, personal and especially social choices, then there's no hope. Why would you resist when you cannot fight biology? So this is a tremendously important fight. And there's a great line by Milan Kundera, the struggle against oppression. It's actually not what he says. What he says is the struggle banned against oppression. Sorry, the struggle. I'm gonna edit it.
Okay.
The struggle against oppression is the struggle of memory against forgetting, and that's part of it. And it's also the struggle. See, that's the thing. That's why I don't like the line the way you said it. The struggle of man against oppression. It's like, I'm sorry, that's forgetting women, you know? So the struggle of, it's forgetting non-humans too. The struggle of men, women, humans, non-humans, the struggle of anybody against oppression. Because if they can get us to forget, then what's the point? That's one of the primary functions of abusive dynamics, is you want for the one who's violated to forget that there's any other way to be. Because if they remember there's another way to be, why would they put up with this? They won't resist when they forget. And it's the same if they can't imagine. One of the things that got me through my childhood was the understanding I had from somewhere that it's not supposed to be this way. Because if you believe it's supposed to be this way, it's all over. And so there's this constant repetition of this is the only way to be. And I mean, all economies have always grown. Not true. Everyone has done an exchange or barter economy. Not true. I was talking to a friend of mine. He's a pretty interesting guy. He's right wing, and he's very interested in currency. And there was an article came out where even a mainstream economist was acknowledging that the cash economy did not emerge as a way to facilitate barter, as some people like to say, because in communities, you don't actually have a barter system either. You have gift exchanges. It's like you go in a family. I mean, in a family, it's like you're building social capital. You know, before I came here, I helped my mom in her garden a little bit, you know? I mean, she didn't pay me for it, for crying out loud, you know? It's like, it's just what you do for a friend. And
but you'll get some food out of it if there's food growing there.
It's a flower garden.
Or some flowers in a vase.
Yeah.
Or the satisfaction that your mom doesn't have to get a backache.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's you know, I'm doing something for a friend, exactly. And that instead, the cash economy emerged from debt peonage. And so the point is, if they can get us to believe that all economies have functioned on this level, if they can get us to believe that all male-female relations are based on power and sexual violence, then it's done. It's the same with If they can get us, I mean, the Talawa, we're on Talawa land, and the Talawa lived here for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science, because there's carbon dating going back that long. Or if you believe the myths of the Talawa lived here since the beginning of time. In either case, they lived here a long, long time. And they didn't destroy the place. It's not inherent. It's not natural for humans to destroy the land where they live. It's not natural for anybody. This is one thing that kills me about the selfish gene theory. It's so stupid. It's supposedly based on fierce competition. You exploit everybody else the best you can. But I can show that evolution is not based on competition in one sentence, if you give me a couple semicolons, which is those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by improving your habitat. That's it. That's how you survive in the long run. Salmon make the forest a better place by their bodies. Bears make the forest a better place by their bodies. And that's central. And back finally to the thing about electricity is in that essay, it was said because some guy was saying, some official in Japan right after Fukushima was saying that they have to keep going with the nuclear because nobody can imagine it without electricity. And here's part of the thing that breaks my heart with all that, is how often do people say, I can't imagine living without salmon. I can't imagine living without dragonflies. I can't imagine living without fireflies. I can't imagine living without an ocean. I can't imagine living without sharks. I can't imagine living without migratory songbirds. Most people at this point don't even notice. The frogs have been population been crushing here.
Most people do live without those things. They don't have to imagine living without them.
That's very true. That's a great point. I live right next to a pond, and when I moved here just 14 years ago, the frogs were so loud at night that you couldn't have a human conversation outside. And they've collapsed. I'm doing what I can to help them, which we can talk about or not, as the case may be. But the point is that I was asking somebody else who lives basically in the same forest area that I do, I asked him if he'd noticed the frogs collapsing, and he said no. And here's the point, is I guarantee that if the San Francisco 49ers disappeared, he would know. You know, this is one reason we don't defend the places we live, is we don't live there. You know, we live with A-Rod and his steroids, and we live with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, and we live everywhere but where we live. And we don't, you know, a lot of people don't even notice. I mean, I just finished putting, moving, my mom gets firewood every year, and it gets dumped out in front of her house, and then I take it in, and usually when I carry in the firewood, or when I carry the firewood later into her house, I always brush off the sow bugs and the spiders before I do, and it used to be, you know, 30 sow bugs per piece of wood. I think this year, when I moved 2 cords in, I think I probably saw a total of 10 sow bugs. I mean, the sow bugs are going. It's, you know, it's not merely that we can't imagine, it's that we don't even, it's like it's not even real. And there's a certain amount of that is I think inevitable, and I don't think I can blame all of it on the culture. A lot of it we can, but there's some existential stuff too. I don't know if this is true for everybody, but I've talked to friends and it's true for them. You know, I'm 52 now, and aging is definitely hitting me. You know, I my vision, you know, I need the glasses, and my memory, it's just, if we would have done this interview 5 years ago, I would have remembered all of those stages of denial that go through.
Our last conversation was 5 years ago, and after it, I mentioned to you that I was having cognitive difficulties that I wasn't having a few years before, and you told me at the time that, yeah, the same thing was happening to you.
It's gotten worse.
Well, she'll attest, it's gotten worse for me too.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff I can't remember at this point is completely nuts. My point I'm getting to is that there's a part of me that doesn't know, I mean, there's a part of me that treats this process as though it's not real, as though I can still do a reset, you know? As though I can, like I'm playing a computer game, and I can go back to that part
your
early on.
Your previously saved position.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And I think that some of that is, you know, I was thinking about this. I lost a cat recently, not dead. She ended up dying, I'm sure, but an indoor cat got out. And I was searching and searching and searching. And I've had this experience before with other sorts of losses where it took me a while to actually realize that this is realized. And at first I'm looking through the forest and it's like, yeah, I'm looking through the forest, but I haven't really internalized that. And this has been true, you know, for all sorts of, whether it's, you know, my grandmother dying or, and it takes a while for something to set in that it's really happening. And I think that there's some level of that. And then there's another level on the biggest scale. Judith Herman has this great line at the beginning of Trauma and Recovery where she talks about atrocities are literally unspeakable in that they are beyond your comprehension, and you can't, there's a part of you that just can't really believe this is happening. And I think about that on the larger scale especially. I mean, I've written 20 some books about this and I still can't believe that this is not a nightmare. I can't believe that, you know, they did calculations where if they figured out that if they would have weighed all the fish in the oceans in 1870 and then they weighed all the fish now, the current weight would be 10% of what it was in 1870. And we have to presume, since it's 1870, that the current weight then was, you know, 50% of what it would have been before, because that was already, there were whales in the Mediterranean before this culture, you know? It's like, so they already had fished out a lot of stuff, killed a lot of stuff. Let's not mince terms here. And there's a part of me that just can't believe that, you know, the oceans have been reduced to 10% of what they were in 1870, and nobody is blowing up trawlers, you know? It's like the trawlers are, they're, you know, clear-cutting the bottom of the ocean. And it's, and the plastic is a ratio, last I heard, which was a while ago, was 10 to 1, and I've heard it's much higher now.
10 to 1.
10 parts plastic per 1 part phytoplankton in the ocean.
Ooh.
Yeah, and this was 5, 6, 7 years ago. And it's just gotten worse. And, you know, I read an article just this morning about how Russia is all excited about the, what do they call it? Not the Northwest Passage, because it's like the Eastern Passage of the Arctic.
The melting of Arctic ice so they can get up the resources.
Yeah, and they're very excited about this. And there's a part of me that can't believe that this is really happening. I mean, you would think a sane person on a planet, which is your only home, and one would think that one would be a little bit worried about setting in motion processes which are entirely uncontrollable. And one would think that one would pause before one would do that. And one would be wrong. So there's a failure of imagination on any number of levels. A failure of imagination of people being able to imagine living without automobiles, which people did just fine 100 years ago. And people have a hard time imagining, which, by the way, I'm not suggesting that individually people should drop their automobiles, because that's not the point. The point is that you have this entire social system that, I mean, I've been recently reading some John D. MacDonald. Don't bother writing him down. He's a thriller writer from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But the point is that he wrote this one book in the 72, I think it was, where he's going on and on. He has all these great asides, and he has this aside about how if people were to look back 100 years from now, they will be absolutely amazed that people built cities for automobiles instead of for people. And that's something I keep asking, and I've asked in several ways, is who's in charge? You know, there's this great line by Frederick Winslow Taylor, in the past, the man was first. Sorry about the sexism. In the past, the man was first. In the future, the system shall be first. And that's really clear to me, that the system is more important than life, including human lives. I mean, it's crazy. When 15,000 people die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers, you know, a line my mom likes to say all the time is, where's the outrage? Right. You know, we still hear, what, 12 years later, about 9/11 all the time. And there were, a great example of this was the Boston bombing. So, I mean, it's terrible. It's a terrible thing. I'm not saying it wasn't. But there was the explosion in Texas right afterwards. And, you know, the people who committed the bombing in Boston, they're these evil, evil people. And the thing in Boston, in Texas, it's accident?
It's a tragedy.
It's a tragedy.
There was an explosion at the bomb factory. Really?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I have a hard time using the word accidents. If you're putting together, it's like the same thing with nuclear weapons, or not nuclear weapons, but yeah, nuclear weapons, which can also include nuclear power plants. But nuclear power plants is if you're concentrating highly toxic and radioactive materials and doing this on an industrial scale, and somebody is surprised when there is a leak of toxic and radioactive materials, I don't understand. This is like if I were to push and push and push on the microphone and then it falls off the table. Like, are we going to be surprised? And it's the same with all this. And that's another thing about it. People are surprised when species go extinct. It's like, what do you think is going to happen when you take away their habitat? They need homes. This is not cognitively challenging. That's one of the things that's really frustrating about all this. None of this stuff is cognitively challenging at all. This is not hard to understand. And I can't, you know, 20-some books later, I still can't understand any of this insanity.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back to its old dimensions.
All right, that was Derek Jensen. You also heard the lovely Olga Kay in that interview. And if you like what you heard in that interview, there is more of it, which you will be able to listen to in this weekend's episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. That will come out on Friday. Olga and I are back from our road trip. We got back last night. And we spent longer at our last stop, Pittsburgh, than we had intended to because the truck broke down a second time. Thank you to everybody who helped with contributions that got us back on the road, moving again, and got us home. It is so good to get out on the road and meet up with Sea Realm listeners, and it is so good to get home. And that reminds me that I have not thanked the sponsors of this week's episode of the Sea Realm podcast. So let me just say that in the past 2 weeks, the following people have either clicked on the PayPal donate button or in some way contributed materially to our journey and to the Sea Realm podcast. So thanks in particular to Connor in Pittsburgh, who put us up for 4 days and fed us and showed us around a collapsing city, a city that is simultaneously collapsing in some places and thriving in others. Thanks also to Scott M., Richard B. once again, Graham S., Bing G., who not only gave us a place to stay in Point Reyes Station and fed us and entertained us in grand style and appeared on this podcast, but who also gave me a guest spot on his radio show. And then after we left and when he heard that we had broken down, made a contribution via PayPal to help get us back on our way. Also, Brandon T. and Jose G. Jose wanted to meet up with us and buy us dinner in San Francisco, and when we didn't get that together, he sent the price of a dinner via PayPal. So thanks to Connor, Scott, Richard, Graham, Bing, Brandon, and Jose. And thanks to everybody else, the people I have probably forgotten to mention, people who may have made cash donations at a live event or in some way helped us on our way. Thank you to everybody who, in one way or another, helps support the Sea Realm podcast. Well, I imagine that there are some Sea Realm listeners who are familiar with the work of Richard Dawkins and who objected to Derek's characterization of Richard Dawkins' selfish gene theory. It is a theory that states that the welfare of the organism is not really germane or relevant to the agenda of the genes. The genes are selfish in that they wish to get themselves replicated, and that they're perfectly happy to do so while sacrificing the organism in which they reside. Richard Dawkins is very careful to state that his selfish gene theory does not make reference to a selfishness gene in humanity, although it's a distinction that is sometimes lost on people. So what I'd like to play for you right now is a bit of conversation that was held on stage between Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins. The first voice that you will hear is that of Richard Dawkins. The second voice is that of Sam Harris. And I think that the themes that Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins discuss in this very short clip are relevant to the discussion you just heard between me, Olga, and Derek Jensen. So, the first voice you will hear is that of Richard Dawkins.
I think it's extremely interesting, and no doubt questions will arise. I just got one final point to make. I get a much less queasy, but a little bit queasy about completely junking the is-ought distinction in the following sense. People think that because I wrote a book called The Selfish Gene, I'm advocating selfishness. So my stock reply to that is, of course, the is-ought distinction, and I presume you would subscribe to that in the sense that we do not wish to say that because something is, quote, natural, that something is out there in nature, that therefore that makes it good. And obviously you're not advocating that, but that is sometimes what people mean by the is-ought distinction. You're meaning something much more subtle, but I just want to throw that in, that I wouldn't wish to throw the is-ought distinction out in that sense.
Well, the idea that natural could somehow equate to good.
Natural equates to good, so we all ought to go around with no clothes on. I mean, that kind of thing.
Right. Obviously, there are many propensities we have that are we've evolved to have, which we are busily trying to get rid of or overcome, and we're wise to. And that's at some point in the book I delineate three different projects, which I don't think we should confuse. The first project is to understand how we came to be the way we are, and this is very much your project of just evolutionary science. We have an account of how we came to be primates who have morally salient emotions like disgust, say. And that's a story for evolutionary biology and psychology. But there's another project, which is we can figure out how we can experience the greatest well-being based on how conscious states arise in the brain and how they're impacted by the world. And that's a very different project. That flies free of the perch that has been built for us by evolution. I mean, that's where we can talk about how to raise compassionate children, despite the fact that and how we could change the genome to be more compassionate, if such a thing is possible. The question of whether all of that is possible is very different from the question of how we got here. And the third project is just to convince people to drop all of the moral commitments that lead to unnecessary human misery, and that's a political and it's a project of persuasion, and that is also distinct, and they often get conflated.
That was Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris elaborating on the is-ought distinction and how it relates to Richard Dawkins' selfish gene theory. I will post a link to that entire talk by Sam Harris. I think it's a pretty good one, in the show notes for this episode, which you can find on crealm.com. And I will leave it to you to decide for yourself whether you think Derek Jensen's criticisms of Richard Dawkins proceed from a misperception of what Richard Dawkins is talking about. Well, that is all the time that I have for this installment of the CRealm podcast. Olga and I will be talking about our road trip and our many experiences and memorable moments that we had on that trip, but not in this episode of the podcast. So tune in to the CRealm Vault podcast and perhaps even a future episode of the CRealm podcast for more about our recent road trip. Thanks again to everybody who helped us along the way. Again, you can hear more of the conversation with Derek Jensen on this week's episode of the CRealm Vault podcast. I hope that you will join us for that, and I hope that you will join me one week from today for another installment of the CRealm podcast. And until that time, I hope that you will stay well.